Because water was so precious on Arrakis, Rondo Tuic's moisture extraction factories at the Antarctic Cap had made him a wealthy water merchant. He had the means to purchase everything a man could desire. Yet he lived in abject terror, doubting he would ever feel safe again, no matter where he fled. Tuic holed up inside his mansion in Carthag, an elegant home filled with beautiful objets d'art he had collected. He had spent a great deal of money to install a state-of-the-art security system and to acquire a wide range of personal defensive weapons. For guards, he had hired off-world mercenaries with no family ties to any of the victims of his treachery. He should have felt safe. After he had revealed the location of the long-hidden smuggler base, Tuic's life had taken a sharp downturn. For many years he had kept the presence of Dominic Bernius secret, accepting bribes from him and helping his smugglers acquire items they needed. He had felt no guilt about playing both sides so long as his profits kept coming in. Later, seeing an opportunity to make a purse full of salaries, Tuic had fingered the fugitive to Count Hasimir Fenring. Well-armed Sardaukar troops had descended upon the smuggler base. He'd never suspected that the renegades had hoarded atomic weapons. Cornered, Dominic Vernius had triggered a stone burner, vaporizing his base, his men, and an entire regiment of the Emperor's soldiers. Considering the possibility of a beautiful female assassin, Tuic had dismissed his concubines and slept alone. Ever alert to the possibility of poisons, he prepared his food himself, and tested every morsel with the finest Cronin poison snoopers. He no longer walked unprotected into the city, fearing a sniper attack. Now the unpredictable Fremen, without explanation, had tersely ended their business relationship with him, and would no longer use him as an intermediary with the Spacing Guild. For years he had worked as a go-between, delivering spice bribes from the Fremen to the Guild. Did the Fremen suspect what he had done? On the other hand, why should they care about a band of smugglers? Still, if they insisted on eliminating his participation, Tuic could have no compunction against reporting their illegal activities to Kaitane. Perhaps Shaddam IV would reward him handsomely, just as Count Fenring had done. But deep-seated fear kept the water merchant trapped within his heavily guarded house. Too many enemies. He tried to find comfort in the soft cushions and silks that surrounded him. The hypnotic hum of outrageously expensive fountains should have lulled him to sleep, but it did not. He told himself, for the thousandth time, that he was being unduly concerned. Liatkynes and Stilgar, along with three other Fremen commandos, easily bypassed the security systems. They could cross open expanses of sand and leave no recognizable tracks. This was no challenge to them. After cutting the throats of two mercenary guards, the Fremen slipped into the water merchant's mansion and glided down the well-lit corridors. "Tuic should have hired better men," Stilgar whispered. Leet had drawn his Chris-knife, but the milky dagger remained unblooded this night. He intended to save his violence for the man who most deserved it. Years ago, young Leet had joined Dominic Vernius and his smugglers down at the South Pole. Dominic had been a great friend and teacher, well-liked by his men. Had left them and returned to the siege, Rondo Tuic had betrayed the renegades. The water merchant was without honor. Tonight, Tuic would receive a different kind of payment, the Fremen gift of justice. They hurried silently down stone corridors, melting into shadows, approaching the merchant's sleeping quarters. It had been a simple matter to obtain detailed plans of the mansion from former servants, town Fremen whose loyalty remained with their sieges. Even though he had never met Dominic Vernius, Stilgar followed Leet, who was now the Abu Naib of all Fremen. Any Razzia commando would have been happy to join this mission. Fremen understood the concept of vendetta. In deep darkness, they broke into Tuik's bedchamber and sealed the door behind them. Their blades were drawn, their footsteps as quiet as oil trickling across rock. Leet could have brought out his Mala pistol and shot the traitor in his bed, but it was not his intention to murder the man. Not at all. Tuik awoke with a start, and sucked in a loud breath to scream, but Stilgar leaped upon him like a wolf. The two thrashed on the slick sheets. Stilgar clamped down on the man's throat and lips to prevent him from calling out. The water merchant's wide-set eyes rolled from side to side, filled with terror. He squirmed, but the commandos held his short legs, pinned his hands to the bed to prevent him from triggering alarms or reaching for hidden weapons. Stilgar said in a sharp whisper, "We don't have much time, Leet." Leet Kynes glared at the captive. Years ago, as a young Fremen emissary, Leet had journeyed to the ice mining facilities to deliver the monthly spice bribe. But it was clear that Tuik did not recognize him now. As a practical matter, Stilgar symbolically cut out Tuik's tongue, so his screams were reduced to gurgling sounds because of the blood pooling in his mouth. As the man retched and spat gouts of scarlet, Leet pronounced the Fremen sentence upon him. "Rondo Tuik, we take your tongue for the treachery you have spoken." With the tip of his kris knife, Leet gouged out the man's eyes, one at a time, and placed the staring white orbs on a bedstand. "We take your eyes for witnessing things you should not have seen." Tuik writhed and struggled in horror and agony, trying to scream, but he only succeeded in spitting more blood. Two of the Fremen commandos frowned at the wasted moisture. With the edge of the blade, Leet first carved off the treacherous man's left ear, then his right, placing the flaps of skin beside the tongue and eyeballs on the bedside table. "We take your ears for listening to secrets not meant for you." All the commandos participated in the final step, chopping off Tuik's hands with a hollow sound of cracking bones. "We take your hands with which you collected bribes, selling out a man who trusted you." At last, they released the merchant to flop and bleed on his bed. Alive, but perhaps better off dead. Before the Fremen left, they drank deeply of the trickling water in the ornamental fountain in Tuik's bedchamber. Then they slipped silently back into the dark streets of Carthag. From this point on, Leet Kynes would deal with the Spacing Guild directly and establish his own terms. A thought derived from intensity of feeling is localized in the heart. Abstract thought must be localized in the brain. Bene Gesserit Dictum, The Principles of Control. Romber wore a well-tailored uniform and dramatic purple cape lined with copper mare silk. His movements were smooth enough now, and the garment so well made, that he could disguise his cyborg body from anyone not looking too closely. Proud to be at his side, Tessia took his arm and accompanied him through the military hangars at the fringe of the Kala Municipal Spaceport. Inside the largest aircraft bay, they met Leto and Thufir. The battering and clanging of maintenance crews filled the building with a tumult that made Romber cringe. "The first step is nearly ready, Prince Romber," Awat announced. "We have purchased passage on a highliner for you and Gurney, but you will follow such a convoluted and time-consuming route that when you arrive at Ix, no one will be able to trace your origin." Wiping grease from his hands and shoving a crystal data board into his pocket, Duncan Idaho hurried over to greet them. "Leto, our fleet is almost ready for inspection. We have completed full checkouts on 26 war frigates, 19 troop dropships, 100 combat thopters, and 58 single-man fighters." Thufir Hawat mentally recorded the numbers, calculated the numbers of salaries the Spacing Guild would charge to transport the entire force, and compared it to the available finances of House Atreides. "For such an extensive operation, we will need to secure a loan from the Guild Bank, my Duke." Leto dismissed the concern. "My credit is solid, Thufir. This is an investment we should have made long ago." "And I will pay back every salary, Leto, unless I fail to recapture Ix for House Vernius, in which case I'll be bankrupt or dead." Noticing the flash of Tessia's sepia eyes, Romber added quickly, "It's difficult to overcome my old ways of thinking, I fear. But I've waited long enough. I wish Gurney and I could leave tomorrow. We have a lot of work to do underground." Leto had eyes for the sleek forms of his military aircraft. They walked past crews that were testing engines, refueling, checking control panels. The men of the Atreides House Guard snapped to attention and saluted their Duke. "Why so many thopters and single-manned fighters, Duncan? This isn't an air or ground battle. We will have to fight our way through tunnels into the underground city." Duncan pointed to the various craft. "Our assault relies heavily on the frigates and troop dropships to deploy nearly a full legion of men as rapidly as possible. However, the thopters and the single-man fighters will hit first and hard, to take out Sardaukar sensor towers and crack open the shielded hatches that lead through the cliff walls." He scanned the cluster of dart-shaped, fast fighters. "If our troops can't get past the surface defenses quickly, the underground takeover is doomed." Leto nodded. Thufir Hawat kept a careful mental inventory of the shields, explosives, lasguns, hand weapons, rations, fuel, and uniforms. This kind of major single-strike assault posed as many business problems as tactical ones. As it was, he would be taking away most of the forces he normally kept in place to defend Caladan. It was a balancing act. However, if the Emperor decided to retaliate against the Atreides' homeworld by sending Sardaukar, no amount of defensive strength would be adequate. The Emperor's dire warning about illegal spice stockpiles, and his astonishingly vicious assault on Zanovar, many houses were tightening their security. Some noble families had voluntarily surrendered long-held spice hoards, at great cost to themselves, while others vehemently denied any involvement in contraband melange. Leto had sent a message to Kaitain, volunteering to submit to a Choam audit, a message that had not been answered. Innocence was no assurance of safety, since records, and even stockpiles themselves, could always be falsified. Thufir cited the example of House Ekaz, whom he considered to be innocent of charges in a recent flare-up. After an infiltrator destroyed a hidden spice stockpile on Grumman, Viscount Hundro Mauritani railed against Ekaz, his arch-enemy. Shortly afterward, another spice hoard was exposed, this one on Ekaz. Indignant, Archduke Armand Ekaz claimed it had been planted there by House Mauritani, simply to frame the Ekazi people. As proof, he offered several already executed Grumman saboteurs. The Emperor was investigating while the two sides hurled charges and countercharges at each other. Liveried courier poked her head into the daylit frame of the hangar. Breathless, she trotted inside and asked questions of one of the mechanics, who pointed toward the Duke and his companions. Leto stiffened, recalling all the times in the past when flushed couriers had delivered urgent messages. Never once, as far as he could remember, had they brought good news. The woman approached Leto briskly, bowed, and asked to see his ducal ring to verify his identity. Satisfied, she handed him a message cylinder, after which he dismissed her with a minimum of courtesy. Romber and Tessia took a step back, giving Leto space in which to read and consider the communique. Duncan and Thufir both stared at him, steeling themselves. "It is an official notice from Kaitain. There has been an assassination attempt on the Emperor," Leto said, his voice low. Then he paled. "And Jessica was in the line of fire. His knuckles whitened as he clenched the open cylinder. His gray eyes flicked from side to side as he absorbed the details. According to this, a madman went berserk during a play. Romber looked at Tessia in dismay. Vermilion hells! Jessica was supposed to go to Kaitain for protection! Is she injured? Duncan asked. Jessica wrote this second note, Leto said, clearly relieved, removing a new sheet of paper. He read it and passed it on to Thufir Hawat, not caring if his mentat saw the private thoughts of his concubine. Leto stood in turmoil, feeling his stomach knot. Sweat broke out on his brow. Against his better judgment, he had come to love her, and now placed so many of his hopes on her unborn child. I am sure there is far more to the story than the official announcement reveals, but still Jessica was clearly not the target, my Duke, Hawat pointed out. If any assassins had meant to kill her, they must have had ample earlier opportunities. Security was far greater with the Emperor present. No, your lady was just in the way. But she would have been no less dead if she had taken a lasgun blast. Leto's face was stormy, his heart wrenched. Lady Anirul requested, no, demanded, that Jessica go to Kaitain for the remainder of her pregnancy. Would I have had to worry about her life if she'd remained here at Castle Caladan? I think not, Duncan said, as if promising his own protection. Around them in the hangar bay, work resumed, its sounds drowning out their low conversation. Leto felt helpless and ready to lash out. Jessica could have been killed. He would fight ferociously to defend her. Losing her would devastate me. His first instinct was to go immediately to the Highliner in orbit and arrange for the first available transportation to Kaitain. Just to be by her side, he would abandon these military preparations, let the others here finish them, and stand ready to tear apart any would-be assassins who dared to cross his path. But when he saw Romber looking at him, Leto remembered the complex interworkings of their secret plans, as well as what Thufir and Gurney had reported about the horrors on Ix. Yes, Leto was a human being, a man, but first and foremost, he was the Duke. Despite his anguish and his longing for Jessica, he could not ignore his duty and leave his best friend Romber and millions of Ixian people to suffer for it. The Padishah Emperor has many enemies and is making new ones every day. He clamps down, seizes stockpiles, threatens to destroy other worlds just as he did Xanavar, Romber said. He continues to clench his fist. Tessia's expression became contemplative. Shaddam's power comes directly from his birthright. He has the throne. But does he have the skill? Leto shook his head, thinking of all the innocent victims that already littered the Emperor's twisted, blundering path. I believe his great spice war is going to backfire on him. Laws are dangerous to everyone, innocent and guilty alike, because they have no human understanding in and of themselves. They must be interpreted, states the Bene Gesserit view. Under the usual cloudless blue sky, yet another imperial garden party took place on the patchwork quilt of lawns, greenhouses, and arboretums on the palace grounds. The squeals of exuberant noble children and the pleasant chatter of courtiers drifted on gentle breezes. Jessica felt that these people had no reality in their existence. Ennui seemed to be their greatest risk. Even decadence must grow dull after a time. She wondered how the business of government ever got done. As a lady-in-waiting, she certainly had nothing to do, though the court Bene Gesserits seemed to be watching her all the time. Had she been on Caladan with Leto, Jessica could have been engaged in monitoring the house finances, checking the disposition of the fishing fleets, tracking weather patterns across the great oceans. She could have been helping Leto heal from his deep grief and channel his anger into productive action. But here she was confronted with nothing more challenging than lawn games. As Jessica negotiated a crushed stone path that meandered past crimson jewel bougainvillea and trumpet-shaped morning glory, the delicate scents reminded her of Caladan. On the Atreides world, dense meadows of starflowers north of the castle thrived in the spring mists. On one warm day, far from the eyes of Thufir Hawat, Leto had taken her to an isolated clearing high above the rugged shoreline. There, on a cushion of thick starflowers, he had made love to her, and afterward they had spent half an hour looking up at the clouds. How she missed her Duke. But she must wait another 4.5 months until her baby was born. Jessica was not allowed to question such things, but silently she could wonder. Mohiam, the teacher who knew her so well, would be gravely disappointed when she discovered the secret of the young woman's rebellion. Jessica feared seeing the betrayal and disappointment on the Reverend Mother's face when she held up a newborn baby boy. Could they kill the Duke's son out of spite? But she squared her shoulders as she walked on. I can always bear a daughter later, as many as the sisterhood might want of me. Jessica spotted young Princess Irulan dressed in an elegant black playsuit that accented her long blonde hair. She sat on a polished stone bench, intent on a film book open on her lap. Looking up, Irulan noticed her.
Good afternoon, Lady Jessica. Have you been eliminated from the tournaments?
I am not a game player, I'm afraid.
Neither am I.
Irulan made a graceful gesture with her hand.
Will you sit?
Anirul, while remaining aloof in the Bene Gesserit way, still paid a great deal of attention to her eldest daughter. The princess was serious and intelligent, even more so than her younger sisters. Irulan held up her film book.
Have you read Lives of the Heroes of the Jihad?
She acted much older than her years, seemed hungry to learn. It was said that the princess harbored aspirations of being a writer one day.
Of course. Reverend Mother Mohiam was my teacher.
She made me memorize the whole thing. There is a statue of Raquelo Berto Anirul on the grounds of the Mother School. Irulan raised her eyebrows.
Serena Butler was always my favorite.
Jessica sat on the sun-warmed stone bench. They watched children run by, kicking a red ball in front of them. The princess put away her film book and changed the subject.
You must find Kaitain quite different from Caladan.
Jessica smiled.
Kaitain is so beautiful and fascinating. I learn new things every day, see amazing sights.
She paused, then admitted,
It is not my home, however.
Irulan's classic beauty reminded Jessica of herself at that age. She was only 11 years older than the princess. The two of them might have been sisters by appearance. This one is exactly the type my Duke should marry, in order to gain stature for his house. I should hate her, but I do not. The Emperor's wife, wearing a long dress of mauve cloth with a golden collar and filigree sleeves, emerged from the garden path behind her.
Oh, there you are, Jessica. What are you two plotting?
Irulan replied.
We're just talking about how amazing Kaitain is.
Anirul allowed herself a momentary flash of pride. She noted the film book, knew that Irulan had been studying while others played court games. In a conspiratorial tone, she said to Jessica,
Irulan seems more dedicated to learning the labyrinth of leadership than my husband is.
She extended a ring-bedecked hand to Jessica.
Come, I have things to discuss with you.
Jessica followed the emperor's wife through a topiary garden, whose shrubs had been trimmed into soldier shapes. Anirul plucked a small, out-of-place twig from the uniform of one of the shrub soldiers.
Jessica, you are different from the hangers-on at court.
who constantly gossip and vie for social position. I find you refreshing.
Surrounded by so much splendor, I must seem rather plain.
Anirul chuckled.
Your beauty requires no enhancement. I, on the other hand, am expected to dress in a certain way.
She displayed the rings on her fingers.
This blue soustone, however, is more than a ring.
She pressed the gem, and a shimmering journal appeared in front of her, the pages dense with information. Before Jessica could read any of the hollow inscribed words, Anirul deactivated the projection.
Since privacy is so rare at court, I have found my diary to be an extremely useful tool for contemplation. It enables me to analyze my thoughts and to sift through other memory. You will know about it, Jessica, when you become a reverend mother.
Jessica followed her on stepping stones that crossed a small water garden, where oversized lilies and aquatic flowers floated.
Anirul continued. I consider my journal a responsibility, in case anything should happen to prevent my memory transference at the end of my life.
Her words left much unsaid. In these critical last days of the long-planned secret breeding program, she, as the Kwisatz mother, needed a written chronicle for those who would follow her. She dared not risk having her life and experiences vanish into an abyss of unrecorded history.
Anirul fingered her soustone ring.
I would like to give you a journal of your own, Jessica. An old-fashioned bound book. In it, you may preserve your thoughts and observations, your most personal feelings. You will come to a better understanding of yourself and those around you.
As they walked around a fountain, Jessica felt a mist on her skin, like the breath of a child.
Unconsciously, she touched her belly, feeling the life inside there, growing.
My gift is already in your apartment. You will find an old blank book inside a small roll-top desk that belonged to my dear friend Lobia. Write in your diary. It could be a new friend for you in our lonely, crowded palace.
Jessica paused, not sure how to respond.
Thank you, my lady. I shall make my first entry this evening.
There are some men who refuse to accept defeat under any circumstances. Will history judge them heroes or fools?
Emperor Shaddam IV, Revised Official Imperial History, Draft.
In bygone glory years, Kamar Pilru had been the Ixian ambassador to Kaitain, a man of stature whose duties took him from the glittering cavern cities to the Landsrad Hall and the Imperial Court. A distinguished and sometimes beguiling man, Pilru had tirelessly sought favorable concessions for Ixian industrial products by slipping payments to one official or another, giving away valuable luxury items, bartering favor for favor. Then, the Tleilaxu had invaded his world. House Gorino had ignored his pleas for assistance, and the Landsrad turned a deaf ear to his complaints. His wife had been killed in the attack. His world and his life were destroyed. Once, in what seemed another lifetime, the ambassador had wielded considerable influence in financial, business, and political circles. Kamar Pilru had made friends in high places, kept many secrets. Though he was not inclined to engage in extortion, the mere perception that he might use a bit of information against another person gave him substantial power. Even after the passage of so many years, he remembered each detail, and others remembered much of it as well. Now it was time to use that information. The warden of the imperial prison on Kaitain, Nani Magar, was a former smuggler and rogue. Judging by her broad, swarthy appearance, some made the assumption that she was a man, and an ugly one at that. Originally from a high-gravity planet in the Unsidor system, she was squat and at least as muscular as a big Anbus wrestler.
Magar had served almost a year in a Nixian prison tunnel before bribing a guard to let her escape. Officially, she remained at large. Years later, upon glimpsing Magar in the Imperial City, Ambassador Pilru had recognized her from confidential Ixion arrest notices. After Pilru had privately revealed to her that he knew, and planned to keep her secret, the warden was in his pocket. For 20 long years he had remained on Kytane, an exiled ambassador from a renegade house, and he had never found a need to call in that favor. Then an actor had boldly tried to assassinate the emperor, making shocking claims concerning the actor's lineage. Those assertions had been outrageous enough to plant seeds in Ambassador Pilru's mind. He desperately needed to see this prisoner, who might be the son of Elrud the Ninth and the imperial concubine Shando Balut, a woman who had later become the wife of Earl Dominic Vernius. If true, Tyros Repha was not only the half-brother of Shaddam the Fourth, but also of Prince Romber Vernius. It was a staggering thought, a double revelation. A prince of Corino and a Vernius locked up in prison, right here on Kytane. Romber thought himself the last survivor of his great house, and believed that his bloodline would end with him. Now there might be a slim chance, at least through the maternal line. Shaddam would never grant him access to Repha, so instead the ambassador decided upon another avenue. Despite the decline of House Vernius, Warden Magar would not want her past crimes revealed. It could only lead to deeper investigations. In the end, the ambassador didn't even have to raise the threat, and she made arrangements for him. When darkness began to settle over the metropolis of Corinth, Pilru took a forest trail along the western perimeter of the palace grounds. He crossed an ivory rock bridge over a stream and disappeared into shadows on the other side. In his pockets he carried certain medical tools, sample vials, and a small hollow recorder, all concealed in a null entropy pouch strapped against his stomach.
"This way,"
a gravelly voice said from the direction of the stream. In the dimness, Pilru saw the boatman he was supposed to meet, a hunched figure with pale, glistening eyes. The motor made a faint purr, holding the craft steady against the current. After Pilru climbed aboard, the flat-bottomed boat rode low in the water. The boatman used a tall tiller to guide them as the simple craft traversed a maze of waterways. Around them, thorn hedges rose high, forming ominous silhouettes against the darkening sky. There were many dead ends in these labyrinthine canals, traps for the uninformed. But the crouching pilot knew the route. The boat rounded a bend, and the hedges here appeared taller, the sharp thorns longer. Ahead, Pilru saw dim lights at the base of a large structure of gray stone. A double-doored metal gate over a water lane led into the penal facility. Lights shone on the other side of the lattice ironwork. Set atop high poles flanking the gate were the heads of four executed prisoners, three men and a woman. Their skulls, still draped in bloody flesh and then coated with a preservation polymer, had been hollowed out and fitted with glow globes, so that an unsettling ghoulish light shone through the eye sockets, mouths, and nostrils.
"Traitor's Gate," the boatman announced, as the metal doors creaked open and the small boat hummed through. "A lot of famous prisoners enter this way, but not many come back out."
A guard on a dock waved them over, and Pilru climbed from the swaying boat. Without asking to see his ambassadorial credentials, the man led him through a dismal corridor that smelled of mold and rot. From somewhere, Pilru heard screams. Perhaps they were echoes from the Emperor's much-feared torture chambers, or simply recordings to maintain an excruciating sense of anxiety among the prisoners. Pilru was guided to a small cell rimmed by a glowing orange containment field.
"Our royal suite," the guard announced, dimming the containment field and allowing the ambassador to step through. The cell stank. Rivulets of moisture ran down a rock wall at the rear of the cell onto the bed and the rough stone floor, where lumps of fungus grew. Inside, a man in a tattered black coat and filthy trousers lay on a bunk. The prisoner sat up warily as they approached. "Who are you? My LaTeX at last?" The guard said to Pilru, "Warden Magar says to give you 1 hour. Then you either go, or you stay." Tyros Repha dangled his booted feet over the edge of the bed. "I have studied the guidelines of the justice system. I know the Imperial Law Code letter for letter, and even Shaddam is bound by it. He is not following—"
"The Carinos are bound by whatever law they choose."
Pilru shook his head. He had learned this personally when he'd decried the injustices on Ix. "I am a Carino."
"So you say. You don't have legal representation yet?"
"Almost 3 weeks, and no one else has spoken to me."
He looked agitated.
"What happened to the rest of the acting troop? They know nothing about this."
"They are arrested as well."
Repha hung his head. "For that I am truly sorry. And for the death of the guard. I did not intend to attack, but only to speak my piece."
He looked at his visitor.
"So who are you then?"
Standing close so that he could keep his voice low, Pilru identified himself by name and title. "Woefully, I am a government servant without a government. When Ix fell to invaders, the Emperor did nothing about it."
"Ix?" Repha looked at him with a touch of pride. "My birth mother was Shando Balut, who later married Dominic Vernius of Ix."
The ambassador squatted, careful not to let his clothes touch anything unsavory. "If you are truly who you say, Tyros Repha, then you are technically a prince of House Vernius, along with your half-brother Romber. You are the only two living members of a once great noble family."
"I am also the only male Carino heir."
Repha did not seem afraid of his potential fate, only indignant at his treatment.
"So you say."
The prisoner crossed his arms.
"Detailed genetic tests will prove my claim."
"Exactly."
The ambassador removed a medical kit from the null entropy container strapped to his stomach.
"I have brought a genetic extraction kit with me. Emperor Shaddam means to keep your true identity hidden, so I am here without his knowledge. We must be extremely cautious."
"He has certainly performed no analyses himself. Either he already knows the truth or he is not interested."
Repha sounded disgusted.
"Does Shaddam just intend to hide me here for years, or quietly execute me? Did you know that the real reason for his attack on Zanavar was to eliminate me? All those people dead, but I wasn't even there."
Pilru, who had developed his diplomatic skills over the years, managed not to show surprise at the startling assertion. "An entire planet sterilized to strike at one person?" But then he could very well believe Shaddam might have tried to take care of the perceived threat to his throne in that way.
"Anything is conceivable. Nevertheless, it serves the Emperor's purposes to deny your existence. That is why I must take samples in order to perform a full and objective analysis. Somewhere far from Kaitain. I need your cooperation."
He could see an expression of hope on Repha's face. The gray-green eyes brightened, and he sat up straight.
"Of course."
Mercifully, he did not ask for additional details.
Pilru opened a slender black case to reveal a gleaming auto scalpel and a capsule syringe, along with some small vials and tubes.
"I will need enough material for several genetic tests."
The prisoner submitted. Quickly, the ambassador collected blood, semen, skin scrapings, fingernails, and epithelial cells from the inside of Repha's mouth. Everything necessary to provide absolute proof of Repha's parentage, no matter how Shaddam tried to cover it up. Assuming that Pilru successfully got the specimens off-planet, of course, he was playing a dangerous game here. When all the samples were taken, Refa's broad shoulders sagged, as if he had finally accepted that he would never get out of this prison alive. "I don't suppose I will ever be granted my day in court." He looked like an innocent little boy. The beloved old docent, Glax Othan, had always taught him to hold justice sacred. But Shaddam, the butcher of Zanovar, considered himself above imperial law. "I doubt it," the ambassador said with brutal honesty. The prisoner sighed. "I wrote a speech for the court, a grand statement in the tradition of Prince Raphael Corino, the role I played in my last performance. I was going to use all of my skills to make people weep for the lost golden age of the Imperium, and make my half-brother recognize the error of his ways." Pilru paused, then removed a tiny hollow recorder from his nullentropy pouch. "Deliver your speech now, Tyros Refa. To me. And I will see that others hear it." Refa sat straight, drawing a magnificent cloak of dignity around himself. "I would be pleased to have any audience at all." The recorder began to hum. Afterward, when the guard returned, Ambassador Pilru stood shaken, tears streaming down his face. As the hazy containment field opened on one side, the guard said, "So, are you staying with us? Should I find you an empty cell?" "I'm coming." Flashing a farewell glance at Refa, Pilru hurried out. The ambassador's throat was dry, his knees weak. He had never before experienced the full power of a trained jongleur. Standing as tall and proud as an emperor, Elrud's bastard son looked at Pilru through the orange haze of the field. "Give my greetings to Romber. I wish we could have met." The key to discovery lies not in mathematics, but in the imagination. Aloha Rund, Early Laboratory Journals. His body still ragged and unrested, Rund hunched over an electronic drawing table, staring at doodles and magnetic lines on the flat screen. Scrolling down the list of his notes, using the few Mentat memory recovery tricks he had learned a long time ago, he had reconstructed, in exact order, every question the Bene Gesserit had asked, every detail he had seen of the wrecked ship. Now that he knew such an invisibility field could exist, he had only to find the path to recreate it. The challenge was formidable. Talis Bault and Director Kinnis stood to one side of the austere laboratory room. "Director, I have been pondering for hours," Bault said. "Haloa's claims sound correct to me, though I can't say exactly why." "I don't remember anything," the director said.